Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do chapter 26, another brief chapter out of 32 in an epilogue from the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and its impact on world history. Title of the chapter is The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window. Looking at the footnotes, briefly, Robert Nemiroff to be young, gifted in black, Lorraine Hansberry in her own words, book from 1969. Richard M. Leeson, Lorraine Hansberry, a research and production source book from 1997. Lorraine Hansberry, The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window by Robert Nemiroff from Random House in 1987. And David J. Garrow, Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference from a 1986 book. And finally, Stephen B. Oates, Let the Trumpet Sound, The Life of Martin Luther King Jr., Harper & Row, one of the main publishers, 1982. Okay, let's go to the text. And as I said, this is a shorter one, maybe 10 pages. 905 through 916, which is blank, so yeah. 15 is blank, so 9 pages basically. I don't know why he has some, you know, chapter 5 and 9 pages and then another one that's 90 pages. It's very odd. Anyway, as if in recognition, chapter 26, The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window, Brustein. Don't know who that is. As if in recognition of her newfound fame, Hansberry, who we heard about in an earlier chapter, is one of the daughters of essentially a blockbuster black who got rich working with the Jews to overturn free association and specifically to destroy the housing covenants that protected white neighborhoods, leading whites to exodus when blacks were moved in, forced in, and one of his daughters becomes a playwright, Lorraine Hansberry. As if in recognition of her newfound fame, Hansberry and Nemiroff left Greenwich Village in 1962 and moved to a country estate in Croton-on-Hudson. At this point in her life, Hansberry, because of her marriage to Nemiroff, had become a living embodiment of the Black Jewish Alliance. She had also become increasingly involved with SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which began to attract significant amounts of Jewish money because, quote, a small coterie of radical northern Jews were attracted by SNCC's militancy and by its willingness to take help from sources viewed with suspicion by more moderate civil rights groups. Because of her Jewish husband and her newfound fame as a playwright and politically engaged intellectual, Hansberry was poised to become a spokesman for the Black Jewish Alliance at the moment of its greatest success. It was precisely at this point, however, that the theoretical issues, which would eventually lead to its demise, began to emerge. In February 1963, Norman Podhoretz published My Negro Problem and Ours in Commentary, the official organ of the AJC, disputing the official view of the nonviolent Negro based on his own experience with Negro gangs in New York. Podhoretz, like Irving Lewis Horowitz, who had grown up in Harlem under similar circumstances, grew up in a world where Negro violence was a daily fact of life. Hansberry, whom Friedman describes as one of the most convinced exponents of Negro-Jewish unity, was blindsided by the Jewish attack and could only retort lamely that Podhoretz had to hold his nose in dealing with Negroes because of some personal aversion. Podhoretz's piece prompted Harold Cruz to write, quote, My Jewish Problem and Theirs, in which Cruz described his mistreatment by Jewish teachers as he grew up in Harlem and the subordination of later black intellectuals to Jewish control. But Norman Podhoretz wasn't the only Jew who was calling the terms of the Black Jewish Alliance into question. Hansberry had a similar run-in with Norman Mailer, whose essay, The White Negro, had effectively defined the Negro as a Jewish fantasy of liberation from sexual morals, which is repeated by Jones himself. More in Libido Dominandi, he goes into that theme. He goes into much greater detail about the environment of Greenwich Village where the blacks and Jews are mixing. More than in this book, he refers to it, but just he didn't really go into it so much. So Norman Mailer and the White Negro is talking about the black is simply a fantasy sex figure for the Jews rather than a real creature. Hansberry suddenly found herself caught in the middle. She believed in sexual liberation because she was a revolutionary, but she didn't like the way that Jews like Norman Mailer defined the Negro as a paradigm of sexual liberation. Setting a precedent which she would follow in her second play, Hansberry saw Mailer as, quote, symbolic of all who fashion their particular fantasies and take the A train to Harlem to find them and go back downtown and write essays not on the prostitutes they met, but on Harlem. But she did not bring up the Jewish issue. Instead, she faulted a fan of group known as the New Paternalists, even though she mentioned the fact that, quote, the most lowly of the barflies in Harlem would start talking about the Jews the moment a writer like Seymour Krim or Norland Mailer left the room. She ended her essay on a consciously ironic note, that's peaceful, urging Mailer not to write of the greatness of our peoples, yours or mine, in the past tense, because better days for the Black Jewish Alliance were just around the corner. In a move that must have set Harold Cruz's teeth on edge, Hansberry ended her essay with a quote in Yiddish, Weil kümmert es noch unser ausgebeckte Show, which Hansberry rendered in English as, because the hour we have hungered for is near. Because the hour we have hungered for is near, after lifting it from Song of the Warsaw Ghetto by Hirsch Glick, a typically beautiful Jewish name.
Hirsch Glick! I can get it for you wholesale!
Hansberry was learning the hard way that if she aspired to be an official spokesman for the Negro, she was going to have to do it on Jewish terms. It was a lesson that James Baldwin had already learned. James Baldwin was, quote, another black writer whose talent was first recognized and nurtured by Jewish editors of small but influential magazines. Elliot Cohen and Robert Warshaw at Commentary, Saul Levitas at The New Leader, and Philip Rav at The Partisan Review. In 1946, Levitas gave Baldwin his first book review assignment, an act the grateful author never forgot. Indeed, in 1961, he told his biographer that these editors had helped save his life. Pre-internet, very, very hard to get into something formally published. There were very few outlets. It's really hard to even imagine that in the day and age of the internet. But I'm of the generation that remembers. Baldwin repaid the favor to the Jews who launched his literary career by misconstruing the conflict in Harlem as black versus white. The Negro facing a Jew, Baldwin wrote in Commentary in 1948, 13 years after Harlem riots had caused a mass exodus of Jewish merchants, quote, hates at bottom not his Jewishness, but the color of his skin. It is not the Jewish tradition by which he has been betrayed, but the tradition of his native land. But just as society must have a scapegoat, so hatred must have a symbol. Georgia has the Negro, and Harlem has the Jew. Baldwin, who apparently never had his Christmas bulbs tested in the Horowitz hardware store in Harlem, they were running a scam he talked about earlier, chapter, claimed that the Negro identifies himself almost wholly with the Jew. The image of the suffering Christ and the suffering Jew are wedded with the image of the suffering slave. Cruz claimed that, and he was a black communist, Jones has been citing almost throughout the work, or since the last couple of centuries that he's covering. Cruz claimed that Baldwin was being disingenuous when he referred to the conflict in Harlem as black versus white. Even when he admits that the Jews in Harlem are guilty of exploiting the blacks there economically, Baldwin attempts to exonerate the Jews by claiming that they are only operating in accordance with the American business tradition. Baldwin's essay on Harlem and Commentary forces Cruz to conclude that he wants to avoid dealing with the facts of the Harlem as they exist. This means, quote, bending over backward to avoid criticism of Jews while pretending to be angry with whites, as well as overlooking the fact that he overlooks, quote, American Jews are very much in control of their situation and have their enemies well cased from all directions. In concluding that the battle in America is ethnic, not racial, Cruz has discovered the triple melting pot, which claims that there never was or has been or will be one homogeneous mass of Americans. The same theory goes on to state that, after three generations, religion replaces country of origin as the source of ethnicity in America. By claiming that the Negro was, in effect, a separate ethnic group, And by denying or ignoring the role which religion plays in defining ethnicity in America, Cruz effectively cut the Negro off from their most important allies in America's culture conf, namely their co-religionists. And it is precisely this issue which Hansberry explored in her second and final play, The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window. So instead of classes coming together, instead of races fighting each other, you have religion. And the blacks are being cut off from their natural white Protestant allies, white Christian allies, in opposing the Jews, is what he's arguing. It was after public brawls with Jews like Norman Mailer and Norman Podhoretz, when a younger generation of Jews was spreading revolution in Mississippi during the Freedom Summer of 1964, that Lorraine Hansberry decided it was her turn to speak out on the Black-Jewish Alliance. Her vehicle was the play The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window, which opened on Broadway in the fall of 1964. As an omen that this exploration of the Black-Jewish Alliance was not going to go well, Hansberry and Nemiroff divorced in 1964. Cruz claimed that Hansberry was, quote, making noisy but superficial integrationist propaganda when she wrote Raisin. His criticism of Brustein is even more biting. Harold Cruz claimed that Hansberry had in effect become a Jew when she married Nemiroff, quote, witnessing the jesting ethnic idea behind the bit of dialogue in Brustein's Window to the effect that Brustein was an assimilationist Jew, but this line has serious folksy intent as far as the playwright's ethnic sentiments went. Lorraine Hansberry had not simply married a man who just happened to be of Jewish antecedents, as the liberal humanist moralist would have had it. She had assimilated into white Jewish cultural life. If so, Hansberry was not a happy Jew. Lorraine's sister Mamie tried to minimize the Jewish-black antagonism that comes out in the play by claiming that Nemiroff's family, quote, in their ethnic way, was very similar to our family. O.C. Davis tried to pour oil in the troubled waters of the Black-Jewish Alliance after Brustein riled them up by claiming that, quote, all subcultures share the common bond of being outsiders. Cruz's analysis of the play is better than the generally clueless interpretation of Brustein as reflecting, quote, harmony and acceptance between blacks and whites, Jews and Christians, and people of varied backgrounds that has succeeded it, but even a cursory reading of Brustein indicates that the situation, as the divorce indicates, isn't as simple as he portrays it either. 14 years after arriving there, Hansberry had discovered that she didn't like Bohemia or its American incarnation, Greenwich Village, which she describes as, quote, the preferred habitat of many who fancy a revolt, or at least detachment from the social order that surrounds us. Sidney Brustein, the main character in the play, is an unhappy Jew, and he is unhappy because he has turned his back on the only identity a Jew has, namely, being a revolutionary. Brustein longs to smite evil with the sword of the Maccabees, but instead he says, L'chaim, and takes a pill for the pain in his oozing intestine. The oozing intestine image is especially interesting in light of the fact that it was Hansberry and not Nemiroff who was dying of duodenal cancer at the time the play was being written, in rehearsal and being performed on stage. By conflating her own very real cancer with Brustein's fictional oozing intestine, Hansberry identifies herself as having internalized the Jewish revolutionary spirit, but not leaving it at that, goes on to hint symbolically that it is precisely the internalization of the principles of Jewish revolution that ends up killing her. Hansberry claims to be grateful for what she learned from the Jews. Speaking through the persona of Irish, she tells Sidney, I have learned a lot after 5 years of life with you, Sidney. When I met you, I thought Kant was a stilted way of saying cannot. I thought Puccini was a kind of spaghetti. Thanks to you, I now know something I wouldn't have learned if it hadn't been for you. In spite of her gratitude, Iris, speaking for Hansberry, feels that she has lost more than she has gained. The Jews have exacted a high price for their participation in the Black-Jewish Alliance that was far higher than the one which Harold Cruz complained about. The price the Negro has to pay for marriage, both literal and figurative, with Jews is, 1, loss of faith in God, 2, moral corruption. At the end of her life, clutching her oozing intestine, Hansberry suddenly realizes that the price she paid was too high, but is unclear what to do about the fact. Hansberry could invoke the name of John Brown, but her diary entries toward the end of her life indicate that she was an ambivalent revolutionary at best. Do I remain a revolutionary? Hansberry wrote in her journal 7 months before her death. Intellectually, without a doubt. But am I prepared to give my body to the struggle or even my comforts? This is what I puzzle about. 1 month later, she seems determined to resolve the issue by throwing herself, quote, back into the movement. But no sooner are the words out of her mouth or pen, and the native hue of resolution is once again sicklied over with a pale cast of thought and, quote, that very impulse is immediately flushed with 1,000 vacillations and forbidding images. Comfort has come to be its own corruption. Comfort. Apparently I have sold my soul for it. I think when I get my health back, I shall go into the South to find out what kind of revolutionary I am. Rather than allowing her to find out what kind of revolutionary she was, Brustein, the play, allowed her to find out what kind of revolutionary she was not. As W.A. Domingo pointed out 40 years earlier, any Negro who aspired to be a revolutionary had to sit at the feet of Russian Jews. But Hansberry soon discovered that the revolutionary spirit was spiritually destructive to Jews and Negroes both. In becoming a Jewish revolutionary, Hansberry alienated herself from her own people, who were, for the most part, devout Christians. As in the past when Odalie Ossing introduced Frederick Douglass to the writings of Feuerbach and the Communist, collaborated with Haywood Patterson the writing of Scottsboro Boy, the Jews in Hansberry's day were still busy trying to turn Negroes into atheists as a way of completing their revolutionary education. The conflict had already appeared in Raisin, which was written 4 years after Hansberry married Nemiroff. When Mama says, quote, God willing, Benethea launches into an atheist tirade. God hasn't got anything to do with it. God is just one idea I don't accept. I get tired of him getting credit for all the things the human race achieves through its own stubborn effort. There simply is no God. There is only man, and it is he who makes miracles. At this point, Mama slaps Benita violently in the face and instructs her, now you say after me, in my mother's house there is still God. The stage directions for Raisin indicate that Benita has been defeated when she repeats, in my mother's house there is still God. In Brustein, Hansberry indicates that the Negro revolutionary has been defeated for the exact opposite reason. Iris and Mavis have been defeated by revolutionary Jews like Brustein who, quote, have all so busily got rid of God for us. Hansberry would later tell Mike Wallace, Benita is me 8 years ago because, as her biographer puts it, quote, at 20, Benita is very much the new woman. She is planning to become a doctor. She will delay marriage until she completes her training. She doubts God and various institutions, and she toys with diverse forms of self-expression, playing the guitar, acting, and horseback riding. But by now it should be obvious that every character was Hansberry, especially by the time she got around to writing Brustein. So perhaps Hansberry is also Ruth, who considers having an abortion in order to prevent adding another financial burden to the family. The issue is formulated in a way that bespeaks rationalization, for no one in the Hansberry family was ever in financial straits, dire or otherwise, since they were rich from the slumlording. And yet, in spite of all the talk about race, Raisin revolves around the abortion issue. Mama has her plant, which is associated with life. It is she who has determined that Ruth not have an abortion. It is she who decides that a move is necessary, no matter what the cost, because, as she puts it, we was going backwards instead of forwards, talking about killing babies and witching each other was dead. When it gets like that in life, you got to do something bigger. The conflict of ideas in Raisin is between Lena and Benita, literally Benita, not between Lena and Ruth. Lena believes in God and is against abortion, reflecting the Christian roots of America's blacks. Hansberry once described herself, quote, as not being hostile to religion unless it happened to be Catholic, but Benita is hostile to religion. Benita is an atheist who believes in free love and as a result would be more likely than Ruth to get pregnant and feel that abortion was a way out of that dilemma. So the question the play brings up is whether Ruth is standing in for Benita, who is standing in for Hansberry, who wants to talk about the sexual issues troubling her conscience in disguised form. We know from her biographer that Hansberry made a conscious decision not to have children. Lorraine's decision not to have children, she writes, evolved from her nurturance of her art. Lorraine the artist triumphed over Lorraine the mother. Again, the very formulation of the issue smacks of rationalization. In fact, in trying to explain her atheism, Hansberry tells one interviewer, "We only revert back to mystical ideas, which includes most contemporary Orthodox religious views, in my opinion, because we simply are confronted with some things we don't understand yet." When the interview counters by saying that Mama gets so much sustenance from this kind of faith, Hansberry goes on the defensive, claiming that she doesn't attack people who are religious at all, as you can tell from the play. Man, however, no longer needs religious crutches because now man exalts himself by his achievements and this power to rationalize, or excuse me, his power to reason. At this point, Hansberry or her interlocutor burst out laughing after Hansberry committed what the folks in Greenwich Village in the 1950s referred to as a Freudian slip. That is, he's saying rationalize instead of reason. Then, as if to cover over what this gaffe revealed about her state of mind, Hansberry added after the laughter died down, "Well, now, of course, his rationalization has its benefits, too. I don't know if he could get along without either." At this point, we'll never know whether Hansberry got pregnant as a result of the affairs she fantasized at the University of Wisconsin, or whether the trip to Mexico was to procure an abortion, or whether an abortion had anything to do with a cancer that eventually killed her. An oozing intestine was a common complication arising from abortion, all of which were illegal at the time. Sometimes it led to death by septicemia within days of the abortion. Sometimes the damage was repaired in time. Whatever the case, the link between a possible abortion and cancer is no more far-fetched than Mamie Hansberry's postmortem, which claims that, quote, "the black experience creates a lot of stress, and a form of cancer can evolve from the emotional stress of racism." They still repeat garbage like that today, that racism is responsible for blacks' bad health. All of that gets covered over by the announcement that Hansberry was a lesbian. The New York critics attacked Hansberry for Brustein's homophobia after Hansberry had Elton say, quote, "After a while, hanging out with queers gets on my nerves." Hansberry, according to her biographer, wrote anonymous letters to various gay and lesbian publications, but the main evidence comes from Nemiroff, who claims that Hansberry's homosexuality was not a peripheral or casual part of her life, but contributed significantly on many levels to the sensitivity and complexity of her view of human beings in the world. A husband attesting to his late wife's lesbianism has an odd sort of ring to it. But when it comes to the posthumous Lorraine Hansberry, we are dealing almost exclusively with the mind of Robert Nemiroff. This meant, of course, that whatever misgivings she had about the influence of Jewish revolutionaries on her life got expunged from the public record after she died, which is when Nemiroff took over her literary estate, OFF. When Brustein opened at Longacre Theater on October 15, 1964, the play was met with mixed reviews, which meant financial problems. By November, the play was already in financial trouble. To counter the possibility that the play might fold, a number of writers, artists, actors, and actresses took out an ad in the New York Times telling New Yorkers that, quote, "Miss Hansberry's new play is a work of distinction. We, the undersigned, urge you to see it now." Many of those who signed the ad were Jewish. Many were black. One, Sammy Davis Jr., was Jewish and black. In November 1964, comedian Mel Brooks and his wife, actress Anne Bancroft, opened their home for a midnight strategy meeting to keep Brustein alive. The fact that prominent Jews like Mel Brooks tried to save the play could not disguise the fact that most Jews did not like it. The New York Times did not like sitting through 2 hours of listening to, as Hansberry put it, the tortures of the engagé. Her way of describing the generation which grew up in the swirl and dash of the Sartre Camus despair of the post-war years as they crossed each other leaving in and out of the Communist Party. Norman Nadel claimed that this play sinks under its own sordid substance. The worst news of all, however, was that, quote, "Hadassah hasn't bought a single theater party." It's a Jewish women's organization. They got a magazine. Before long, it was pretty clear that Hadassah stayed away in droves because it did not like what Hansberry had to say about Jews. In the end, all efforts to keep the play on life support failed, and Brustein died on the same day that Lorraine Hansberry did, on January 12, 1965. After Hansberry died, Robert Nemiroff, now her ex-husband, chose as the epigraph for her black marble tombstone, Brustein's Hosanna to the Jewish revolutionary spirit. Quote, "I care. I care about it all. It takes too much energy not to care. The why of why we are here is an intrigue for adolescents. The how is what must command the living, which is why I've lately become an insurgent again." After Hansberry's death, Nemiroff took over the promotion of her writing. When he did, all the ambivalence toward Jewish revolutionaries disappeared. In a letter to Lisbeth Vorijevervi, a Swedish scholar, Robert Nemiroff wrote that, quote, "Jews have played an extraordinary role, out of all proportion of their numbers, in all democratic, liberal, and radical humanizing and liberating movements, and that, quote, other oppressed peoples, especially in the Hitler years and in their aftermath, have recognized this tacitly and often explicitly and have tended to look at Jews for greater understanding. As allies or potential allies, or at least as the least hostile ethnic group in the society at large, this may or may not be true. The question, however, is, if Hansberry felt this way, why did she write Brustein? Young, Gifted, and Black, Nemiroff's redaction or editing of her writings, won a Golden Globe Award in 1973, so he semitized it for Jews' protection. Unlike Young, Gifted, and Black, which was the Jewish reading of Hansberry, Brustein was a prophetic play because it foreshadowed the collapse of the Black-Jewish alliance. Friedman sees the first signs of the collapse at the 1964 Democrat convention in Atlantic City, which was soon followed by a riot in Harlem, which was followed by riots in the ghettos of the cities across the country. As in Harlem, so also in Philadelphia, which had its own riot, Blacks targeted small shopkeepers, almost all of whom were Jews. Friedman, who is head of the Philadelphia branch of the AJC, claims that 22 Jewish merchants were killed, and 27 were shot or beaten in Philadelphia alone over the course of the 4 years from 1968 to 1972. From 1964 until 1968, there were 329 riots in 257 cities across the country, and in just about every instance, it was Blacks attacking Jews and accusing them of price and rent gouging. It was the riots and the Black attack on Jewish merchants which prompted many Jews to pull out of the civil rights movement. When Israel went to war in 1967, many Jews pulled out for good and devoted their energies and their money to supporting Israel. Malcolm X was murdered on February 21, 1965, but by the time he died, there were many who were willing to take up the tattered banner of Black nationalism and return to a more virulent version of the vision, which everyone had pronounced dead, when the NAACP succeeded in silencing Marcus Garvey. It was Harold Cruz, however, and not Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote the definitive book on the Black-Jewish Alliance, so definitive, in fact, that it caused the collapse of the alliance. When the crisis of the Negro intellectual arrived at bookstores in 1967, the civil rights movement was quagmired in a crisis of purpose from which it would never emerge. Of course, one of the reasons it never emerged from its crisis lies in how well Cruz documented Jewish involvement in Negro affairs. Sheryl Greenberg argues that Cruz's claim that Jews, quote, deliberately manipulated the movement for their own ends is not simple anti-Semitism because, quote, a look at the historical record suggests that Jews did have a great deal of self-interest in promoting a civil rights movement based on integration, and they did indeed turn away from the movement in the 1960s as their self-interest increasingly conflicted with it. Greenberg concludes by saying that, quote, the golden age of Black-Jewish alliance never existed. Rather than try to refute what Cruz said, the Jews just lost interest in the plight of Black folk. When Israel warred with Egypt in the same year, that loss of interest became permanent. When Lorraine Hansberry died on January 12, 1965, her family received a letter of condolence from Martin Luther King, which praised, quote, her creative ability and her profound grasp of the deep social issues confronting the world today, and claimed that it would, quote, remain an inspiration to generations yet unborn. Martin Luther King had just rented an apartment in Chicago's Black Belt and was planning an assault on what he saw as segregation in housing in that city. One of the great mysteries of the civil rights movement was why Martin Luther King got involved in the housing situation in Chicago, a decision that would bring about the biggest debacle of his career. His letter gives some indication that a raisin in the sun was on his mind when he made the decision. After months of preliminary work, Martin Luther King arrived in Chicago to kick off his housing drive in June 1966. As one of his first acts, King, drawing on the symbolism of his namesake, attempted to nail the housing equivalent of 95 theses to the door of Chicago's City Hall, but had to settle for taping his theses after he discovered the door was made of steel. Chicago had been a racial battlefield since the Chicago Housing Authority, the Quakers, B'nai B'rith, ADL, and Lewis Wirth redoubled their effort to complete the social engineering of Chicago's ethnic neighborhoods that had begun during World War II. Beginning in 1946 at Airport Park and spreading across the South Side, racial war raged throughout the 1950s and 60s. The local politicians reached a modus vivendi in 1954 when the mayor fired the head of the Chicago Housing Authority, but the issue was not local. The federal government was promoting racial migration and the ethnic cleansing of Catholic neighborhoods in all of the major cities of the North and East. The Catholic Church, which had a huge financial stake in the outcome of this battle, was, if anything, divided on the issue, with rank-and-file Catholics throwing rocks through the windows of newly arrived Negroes, while at the same time the hierarchy and much of the clergy welcomed the civil rights movement with open arms. If you notice this, and this goes through history, the upper echelons of the clergy have always been willing to work with the anti-whites and Jews to protect them from angry basic white Catholics, basic Catholic whites. In 1963, Chicago's branch of the Catholic Interracial Council organized a centennial celebration of the Emancipation Proclamation, which featured speeches by Martin Luther King and Chicago's ordinary, Albert Cardinal Meyer, who told the assembly, quote, "Our whole future as a nation and as a religious people may be determined by what we do about the race problem in the next few years." Meyer's successor, John Cardinal Cody, continued this rhetorical and symbolic support for civil rights, and many priests, nuns, and lay people played an active role in the growing civil rights movement. Catholics working with blacks against whites. Catholics working with blacks and Jews against whites. Cody met privately with King on February 2, 1966, and gave his tacit support to King's housing campaign. When King held his mass rally at Soldier Field that summer, tacit support became open support when Auxiliary Bishop Aloysius Wycheslaw, representing the Archdiocese of Chicago, read a statement from Cody affirming that, quote, "Your struggle and suffering will be mine until the last vestige of discrimination and injustice is blotted out here in Chicago and throughout America." Since Chicago had acquired a reputation as a Catholic town, King's success there seemed assured. But things started to go wrong from the beginning, and they never ended up going right. When King stepped out of his car to lead a march through segregated Marquette Park, segregated in quotes, he was greeted by a hail of rocks and bottles, one of which hit him on the head and made him stagger to his knees. The Lithuanians, who would later set fire to the marchers' cars and chase Jesse Jackson down 63rd Street, were outraged by the fact that people from another part of the country would come into their neighborhood and tell them who to sell their homes to. Or, he actually just says, and tell them to sell their homes. That wasn't precisely King's message, but the simple fact of the matter was that no one, not even the Chicago Tribune, knew exactly what King's message was. According to an editorial in the Chicago Tribune, the message of the, quote, paid professional agitators, unquote, who made up the march was, quote, give up your homes and get out so that we can take over. King was befuddled, as Mayor Daley indicated, because he didn't understand Chicago. One of King's lieutenants only strengthened this suspicion when he said in effect, she said in effect, Chicago was different than what they had expected. Quote, down south, the SCLC's Dorothy Tillman opined, you were either black or white. You weren't Irish or Polish or all of this. Mayor Daley was quick to capitalize on SCLC ignorance of Chicago. When King announced that he intended to end slums in Chicago, Daley announced that Chicago already had a slum clearance program staffed by people who knew more about the city than he did. What the hell is King doing here anyway? Daley's staff wanted to know. Doesn't he think we care about the slums? Why Chicago instead of Atlanta or Harlem? King has no knowledge of Chicago. When King announced the SCLC planned to march in Gage Park, Daly countered by saying that King was, quote, very sincere, but lacked, quote, all the facts of the local situation because, after all, he's a resident of another city. When Daly suggested in April 1966 that King go home to Georgia, seven Negro committeemen seconded his suggestion. King's Jewish backers had a sense of foreboding about Chicago as well. Both Bayard Rustin and Stanley Levison, quote, sensed disaster. Friedman claims that Levison sought to restrain his friend, but failed to do so. The main problem was King's unfamiliarity with the situation in Chicago. King's knowledge of the housing situation in Chicago was based largely on a raisin in the sun. When King vowed that, quote, he would lead a rent strike unless the city's landlords improved their properties immediately, he failed to understand that many of the landlords were black and that Hansberry Enterprises was one of the biggest slum landlords in Chicago. King was caught up in a world he did not understand, and his ill-fated Chicago campaign soon turned into disaster, the disaster that Levison and Rustin feared it would become. Friedman claims that Levison was the voice of moderation in King's circle, claiming that Levison had told King, "You don't call for insurrection in a place where you're outnumbered or outgunned." But it was equally obvious that Levison wanted King to succeed for ethnocentric reasons. King, quote, was the last major black leader to promote the legitimacy of Zionism within the black community. If King were to be discredited in Chicago, his defeat would open the door for King's black nationalist competitors who were no friends of Zionism. Like Marcus Garvey before them, and like Malcolm X and Harold Cruz, the black power advocates of the mid-60s realized that integrationism and black nationalism were incompatible. They also realized that Zionism and Black Zionism were incompatible according to the terms of the Black-Jewish Alliance. After his failure in Chicago, King's assassination was merely anticlimactic. The, quote, beloved community that King and others in the Black-Jewish Alliance had tried to create during the 50s and early 60s had died 2 years before he did. And that ends the chapter. So all these things, that whenever you see something assigned, sure enough, oh my gosh, the author was working with the Jews. And then she died, and her mixed feelings about Jews were whittled down to being Jew positive by her late Jew husband, her ex-Jew husband, the literary manager of her estate, apparently. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do chapter 27, the third session of the council, back to Vatican II.